It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, The Last Moment, part three of our series on death. What happens when we die? When it's time to let go, take that last breath. It's so hard to imagine. As long as we're sitting here, breathing in and out, aware of everything around us, it's almost incomprehensible. As far as we know, we're the only creatures on the planet who have to go through our whole lives knowing there's a deadline. Mostly we try not to think about it, but maybe if we got closer to death, it wouldn't be so scary.
I was very uncomfortable with death for most of my life. I grew up across the street from a cemetery and was terrified of death. If anyone was aging, ill, dying, I went the other way. I had many friends that were diagnosed with serious illnesses. I hate to admit it now, but I was unable to be with them.
Karen Ruppin was like a lot of us, scared of death and dying, uncomfortable even talking about it. But then something happened. She got a job at the one place she couldn't possibly avoid death, hospice.
I can't recall the first death that I witnessed, but it was an elderly woman, and she was non-responsive, and it was a very quiet, peaceful death. I mean, her breathing became a little irregular, and I sat next to her, breathing with her and holding her hand, and after one final exhale, that she didn't have another inhalation, and it was very quiet and very peaceful.
And how did that affect you?
I think I was amazed that the way that people die is just such a mystery. There's life there, and then there's something so different. It's hard to talk about. I think you have to be there and witness the before, during, and after. How, after someone takes their last breath, the physical body is still there, but there's something else that isn't, at least not in the same realm that it was just moments before. Just moments before, one inhalation before.
Isn't that terrifying?
It isn't terrifying to me anymore.
By now, Karen has been present for many deaths, and not only is it no longer terrifying, like a lot of people who work in hospice, she mostly seems to feel a sense of mystery and even wonder in death. I've heard that people who've worked in hospice very often think death is not the end. I've had people say to me, there's weird stuff that you see that you can't explain. Is that true?
It's true for me. I've been with people who describe things that I don't see in ways that seem to be very comforting and exciting for them. I've seen people talk about others that they see in the corner of the room. There's a lot of symbolic talk. I mean, people will say, well, I need to go upstairs, or where's the key? I need my coat. Make sure that my ticket is ready.
And what do you make of it?
They're getting ready to go wherever they're going, and they know it. They know. I remember a New Year's morning, I was sitting with a woman who was describing to me something that she saw out her window. And it was a white dog that was running into the woods, and it would come back to her window and then turn around and go back into the woods. And instead of saying, oh, there's no white dog out there, instead, I asked her more about it, and she told me that she will be following that dog. And the way that she spoke about it was so filled with joy and knowing, I just felt that it was such a gift for her to share that with me.
So I'm watching your face, and you're smiling. There's a bit of joy, wonder?
All of the above. Joy and wonder to be a part of this part of life.
Karen Reppin is a hospice professional. She leads workshops and public conversations on death and dying. So it's one thing to watch other people die, and it's another thing to prepare to do it yourself. For the past two episodes, we've been following the story of Dan Perotti and his wife Judy. Here's Seth Jovag with the third installment.
Dan had been living with congestive heart failure for 25 years. Last winter, he was taking a lot of pills and a pacemaker just to keep him alive. And as his health got worse, his quality of life was going with it. He and his wife, Judy, started wondering if he should just stop taking his medication. It was, literally, a life or death decision.
He turned inward more and more and more. And we would sit and have a meal together, and he hardly spoke. He just didn't have it in him anymore. The hospice doctors and the pastor, they were all asking him questions, but I don't know that they asked him the right question. They were saying to him, "Are you afraid of death?" And he was very emphatically saying, "No, I'm not afraid of death." And he wasn't. That night, I sat at the end of the bed and I said, "I know you've said you're not afraid of death." And then I said, "Are you afraid of dying?" And he said, "Yes, I'm afraid of dying." And I asked him what it was that frightened him, and he said, "The unknown and the process of dying and probably the discomfort in dying." And so we talked about that. I promised him that he would never be uncomfortable to the extent that we would use everything in our powers to keep him comfortable, and that I wouldn't leave his side, that I would be there and walk with him through this process. And I think it was shortly after that that he made the decision to stop the medication. He spoke with the doctor about going off the medications, and the doctor indicated to him that he thought if and when Dan went off the medications, he probably would not live for very long, a couple of days to a week. And Dan made the decision then to go off the drugs that day, right here at this table. "I'm done. No more pills." That was it. And on that Monday, on the 10th, now he'd been off for 10, 11 days off the medications, and he woke up that morning and he was very uncomfortable. So I gave him a double dose of morphine right away. And an hour later, he was still very uncomfortable. So I gave him a second double dose of morphine. And our hospice nurse, Shannon, called and said, "How's it going?" And I said, "I can't control the pain." And she said, "All right, we're going to put him into the IPU, the inpatient unit." And we knew he could hear us, but he was just not responding. He was smiling every once in a while, but that was all. And our dear friend, Jim Murphy, walked in, and Jim has always walked in wherever Dan has been and kissed Dan on the top of his head, and Dan has always rolled his eyes. I watched his face when Jim went over to him and kissed him, and he couldn't roll his eyes anymore, but you could see that he was trying to. And then Jim said, "Hey, Dan'l, I've got a great joke. Can I tell you a joke?" And Dan said, "No." And that was his last word. That was it. By Tuesday, he had slipped into a coma. So we were talking to him, but we never felt that release, because he was fighting this. He was fighting dying. And the doctor that we saw on Monday, she said, "Maybe we should talk about turning off his pacemaker if this is something that you want. And I said, "Absolutely." I mean, Dan had been in a deep coma for about 5 days. So Medtronic was on its way over, but he died before they got there. We were all there with him. four kids, we were all holding on to him, just holding on to him, and we were crying. It was very sad, but it was very beautiful because he knew we were there. I mean, as much as he could know, and they say that hearing is the last thing to go, we were all talking to him. We were telling him we loved him. And he just took his last breath, and then he was gone. It was so simple, and it was really, it was very beautiful. And he was gone.
That's Judy Perotti talking about her husband, Dan. We'll bring you more of their story in the next episode of our series on death. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series on death is supported by the Neuer Foundation, dedicated to exploring meaning and commonality in human experience. More at neuerfoundation.com. And by Promega Corporation, investigating and supporting the science of life.
In this hour, we're talking about what happens when we die, about the mystery of that transition from life to death. Well, it turns out it's even more mysterious than we thought, because some recent medical advances are blurring the line between life and death. Sam Parnia is director of resuscitation research at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. He's a critical care doctor, and he tells Steve Paulson that in some cases, death is not as final as we thought.
When you become a corpse, it's only at that time that the cells inside the body start to undergo their own process of death. And actually, brain cells can remain viable while non-functioning for a lot longer than we thought, perhaps many hours of time.
So just to be clear about this, you're saying that it's possible for people to die in the technical definition of death and yet still come back to life.
Absolutely. So it's not that it's possible if people do die, but what is possible is to still bring them back for a significant period of time after they have died. And the reason for that is because the cells inside the body have not yet become irreversibly damaged as a consequence of the lack of oxygen that's getting to them. And we used to think that we only had 4 or 5 minutes before brain cells would become irreversibly damaged. And now we know that was completely wrong, that we have many hours of time. And therefore, the art and science of resuscitation of the 21st century is learning how to manipulate those cellular changes that are occurring in the brain cells and other cells to prevent them from going to a point where they're irreversibly damaged, while at the same time restarting the heart and bringing back a whole person without brain damage.
This sounds like a strange definition of death. I mean, I guess, why not just say that someone dies when they are gone once and forever? Why say that, you know, death is this thing that happens, you know, after cardiac arrest, but they still can come back?
Well, the reason for that is because, and you pointed out something here, most people, when they hear the term cardiac arrest, they think you're talking about like a subset of people who've died, say, from a heart attack. Cardiac arrest is a medical term for death. It's when the heart stops beating for whatever reason, say someone who's in a motor vehicle accident, meningitis, they've cancer, whatever you can think of that causes a person to die. When they die, that's called cardiac arrest. Now, what we're finding is that the advances in resuscitation science are beginning to challenge our understanding of what death really is. So we used to think clearly there's a black and white, you know, you're either dead or you're alive. And now we know that there's this long and significant period after you die in which you enter this gray zone where death can be reversed.
So what do scientists know now that they didn't know 10 or 20 years ago? I mean, why has this ability to bring people back after death, why has it expanded so much?
We now know that cell death is a biological process that takes place through enzymatic processes. In other words, there are catalysts, chemical catalysts, that lead to cells to die. We know that chemical changes need heat. So if you were to cool down the body, you will slow down the rate by which the chemical steps that are taking a brain cell that's potentially viable into a state of irreversible damage is taking place. You can slow down that rate. Now, we're not talking about cryogenics, we're not talking about freezing, we're talking simply about chilling the body from 99 degrees to, say, 92 degrees Fahrenheit, so just a little bit.
And is there anything else besides cooling the body that you're doing?
You find there are things done in other countries. For instance, in Japan and South Korea, as well as Taiwan, one of the things that's pretty much their standard of care is they have a device called extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. It's essentially a system by which they take blood out of a person's body, it goes to a membrane, and the membrane delivers oxygen to it, and then it's pumped around the body. And by doing that, they're giving their doctors hours of time to slow down the rate by which brain cells are dying and go back and fix the underlying problem that caused the person to die. Go back, try and fix the problem, and get them back again. And they're having enormous success by doing that. But incredibly, in the United States, it is not standard of care. You'll be lucky if they have it at a hospital. And if they do have it, it's very patchy, whether they use it for these patients or not. And so that is a real game changer we found in this field.
This is really remarkable, what you're talking about. I mean, just what science, what medicine has discovered about how to bring people back to life. And we should talk some about case histories here. I mean, you've had a lot of personal contact with these, and you tell some remarkable stories in your book, Erasing Death. Tell me about Joe Tirolosi.
He's a 57-year-old gentleman who was a chauffeur driver who came to Cornell Medical Center, where I used to work. And essentially, as soon as he arrived, his heart stopped, and he died. He came, and he had almost 50 minutes of CPR, where most doctors at that point would have given up on him. And incredibly, at about that time, they managed to restart his heart, while at the same time, as we said, cooled him down, using primitive stuff, ice packs, you know, taking literally bags, filling up from the drinks vending ice machine, and putting it all over his body, cooling him down to preserve his cells. And then he was taken to the cardiac catheterization laboratory, and they found that he has a massive heart attack, which is what had caused him to die. They fixed the problem, took him to the coronary care unit, and they all thought he's going to be brain damaged because he had such a long period of cardiac arrest. But incredibly, he recovered, and when they took him out of his coma, he started telling the nurses and people there that he had this very profound experience that had completely changed him. So it put together a number of the most critical elements in bringing a person back.
And the profound experience you just mentioned is what we would call a near-death experience, although you don't actually like that word, do you?
Yes. Traditionally, people have called these near-death experiences. And it's interesting, if you look back at the history, CPR was discovered in 1960. So it was only then that medicine found the way to bring more and more people back to life after they would have traditionally been declared dead and could not have come back again. And by 1975, the first book was published that described these incredible experiences that people were having when they'd been critically ill and sometimes going beyond the threshold of death, in other words, having a cardiac arrest. Now, unfortunately, at that time, this was so new, and the person who wrote it, his background was philosophy and he was a psychiatrist.
This is Raymond Moody.
Raymond Moody, that's right. He termed these near-death experiences, which at the time I think was appropriate, but now looking back scientifically is enormously problematic because there is no such term as being near death in medical science. You may be dead or alive, but there's no such thing as being near it.
So what's the phrase that you would prefer then?
The experiences that they have after going through cardiac arrest, which is the same as death, I refer to as an actual death experience, which is very different to this ambiguous, vague sort of collection of experiences that have been put under the umbrella term of near-death experiences.
Sam Parnia directs resuscitation research at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. His book is called Erasing Death. So no matter what we call them, Those stories about tunnels with a light at the end, family members waiting, a life review, well, they're fascinating. They make dying sound like something you could maybe look forward to. But they are just stories, and completely unverifiable, aren't they? Steve Paulson brings us a report on how science is beginning to grapple with near-death experiences.
To get a sense of the controversy over near-death experiences, you almost have to start with Eben Alexander, the neurosurgeon who nearly died in 2008 from a rare form of bacterial meningitis. He was in a coma for a week, and when he came out of it, he said he had proof of heaven because he'd been there.
I was aware of many souls dancing, and I remember gold and silver arcs. And from these arcs were coming choral hymns. The power behind that music, so infinite and awe-inspiring music, more beautiful than anything I could imagine on earth.
Alexander's account was remarkably detailed. He not only heard heavenly music, he felt a warm summer breeze and rode beside an angelic being on the wing of a giant butterfly.
And it changed everything for me. That warm breeze was this breath that led me to know that this was the creative, infinite power of the divine.
Eben Alexander's account of his near-death experience got a lot of traction because of his impeccable credentials. He's a former neurosurgeon who taught at Harvard Medical School. As you can imagine, media outlets went crazy over it. He landed on the cover of Newsweek magazine and was interviewed by Oprah Winfrey, Nightline, and all the rest. But it's not so much his story of glimpsing the afterlife that's generated so much controversy. It's Alexander's claim that he had this entire experience while his cortex, the part of the brain that controls our thoughts and feelings, was offline.
He did not present any credible case to suggest that his brain had shut down.
Sam Harris, the noted atheist and neuroscientist, is Alexander's most outspoken critic.
And his brain is obviously back online because he remembers his experience. And there's no evidence he's presented that suggests that he couldn't have had his NDE, his near-death experience, when his brain was coming back online.
You're saying part of the problem is he was coming out of his coma, or his brain was coming back online, and that's when he recalled these experiences?
Or had them. First of all, there's no evidence that his brain ever totally shut down. That is neurologically an implausible claim. Even people in comas have 50 to 70% of the kind of neural activity you expect in a normal person. So let's just grant him that his brain did shut down. It's back now. So the plausible time to place his experience is in the reboot, not when it was offline, because he remembers this stuff.
So there's a deeper issue here. Eben Alexander and other people who've had near-death experiences believe they're evidence of an afterlife or some other dimension of reality. But according to the reigning paradigm of brain science, you can't have conscious awareness, let alone visions of heavenly beings, if your brain has flatlined. So when your brain dies, your mind can't just detach itself and float away, can it?
You know, the reality is we just have no idea how the mind is connected to the body. That's an impenetrable philosophical question.
Raymond Moody is the psychiatrist and former philosophy professor who first coined the phrase near-death experience back in the mid-70s. He's collected thousands of stories of NDEs, and he says they have a lot in common.
All over the world, there is a common pattern. People tell us about a dramatic transformation of perspective where suddenly they feel they exit their body and start observing the scene of the resuscitation from above. They actually see their physical bodies being resuscitated. They tell us about passage through some sort of a tube or tunnel into another world where they encounter a brilliant light far brighter than anything that we know while we're alive, and yet completely comfortable, joyful. They tell us that relatives or friends of theirs who have already died seem to be there almost as greeters, just greeting people who come in. And people, when they come back from this, they tell us their lives are transformed, that whatever they had been chasing before, that after this they think the most important thing we can do while we're alive is to learn how to love.
Raymond Moody says most people who've had near-death experiences come to believe that death is not the end, but a transition into another reality, and their own fear of death often disappears.
I am convinced that consciousness continues, that we are always connected with loved ones, that there is an order rather than a chaos to life and death.
That's Lani Leary, a psychotherapist who works with people who are dying. One reason she went into this line of work is a near-death experience she had when she was 28, when she went into anaphylactic shock after inhaling nitrous oxide during a dental procedure and was unconscious for about 10 minutes.
One minute I was in lying back in the dentist chair, and the next minute I was aware that I was up in the corner of the ceiling of the room. No pain, no fear, no anxiety, but observing the dentist who was frantic. The next thing I knew, I was going into a tunnel, and my mother was at the entrance of the tunnel with her arms open wide. I hadn't seen my mother in 15 years. She'd been dead for 15 years. I knew that she knew all the details of my life that I so badly, you know, wanted to tell her every single day that she was gone. There was just such peace. And the next thing I knew, I was being drawn to a point of light at the end of a tunnel. And I went through this tunnel with beautiful, beautiful music. And then the light was all around me. And then I was inside the light, almost as though the light and I were one. And I knew in every fiber of whatever I was that I was loved and forgiven beyond anything I'd ever experienced or have since. And I wanted to stay there. And the light communicated to me, again, telepathically, but I felt it. You have to go back. And with all of me, I yelled, no. And again, the light said, you have to go back. You have work to do. And the next thing I knew, I was coming back through the tunnel and, you know, regained consciousness back in the dentist chair.
So what are we supposed to make of a story like this? Take one of the main components, the out-of-body experience, rising up out of your body, hovering overhead, hearing and seeing what's going on down below. Can science explain any of this?
There's actually very little to no controversy in the neurologic circles about out-of-body experiences. One of the remarkable things is that they're actually very common. 1 in 20 people are going to have an out-of-body experience in their lifetime.
Kevin Nelson's a neurologist at the University of Kentucky who's written a book about near-death experiences. He says there's a purely physiological explanation. The tunnel in the white light? It's caused by low blood flow when oxygen is cut off from the brain. The first thing to go is your peripheral vision, but the center of your vision is still there, so you get the tunnel-like sensation. Then once your eyes lose all blood flow, you can only see light. Nelson also speculates that the vivid images in NDEs are triggered by what he calls a REM intrusion. That's the rapid eye movement brain state when you dream. But in this case, there might be a merging of dreaming and waking states of consciousness. At a recent debate on NDEs at the New York Academy of Sciences, Nelson said not only are out-of-body experiences incredibly common, they can actually be induced. And there's a guy in Switzerland who's done it.
Ulf Blank, a neurologist in Switzerland, has taken an electrode in this area, and you apply the current that's about 1/100th of a 60-watt light bulb. When you flip the switch on, boom, they're out of body. They can be above, they can be hovering behind. Turn the switch off, they're back in.
So, out-of-body experiences explained? Is it all just neural fireworks?
Okay, Peter, do you accept this explanation of out-of-body experiences?
Not much.
Neuropsychiatrist Peter Fenech is one of Britain's leading NDE researchers. He's analyzed more than 300 cases, and he's especially intrigued by one of the key experiences that people report.
One would normally think, okay, the person comes out of their body and then goes down the tunnel or something. It's not quite like that. They come out of their body and they perceive what is going on around them. The next thing about the experiences is that they don't only get information from where they are in the OR room, they get it also by going through walls and hearing conversations from other people in different rooms, and there's no way that they could hear it. Now, if that is true, then it suggests that mind and brain can separate.
You know, for a subject that used to be off limits for scientists, near-death experiences are getting closer attention in labs and field studies all around the world. But how much will they ever be able to explain? The Australian sociologist Alan Kelleher has looked closely at the NDE studies, and he says there are so many unanswered questions, so many cross-cultural variables, that science alone won't unpack the mystery.
And the other thing is that if tunnel sensation or life review was due to physiological processes, then you would expect a New York businessman and a New Guinean tribesman to have exactly the same experiences. But in fact, some of these characteristics are not even cross-cultural. So we haven't found a case of a hunter-gatherer who's had a life review because their particular psychology doesn't worship individual biography.
So how do you explain this? Can you explain it? Why people have these experiences? I mean, is it contact with the other side, with another dimension?
I don't think I can answer that question. I'm not sure what it is. I can tell you that the hallucination explanation is a bad one. It's got lots of holes in it. They may be a special type of hallucination, maybe, or they may be a window to the afterlife. But I can tell you that the evidence at this stage does not answer it for us.
If you're still curious about near-death experiences, you'll find more of Steve's interviews on the subject and the video of that New York Academy of Sciences debate on our website. That's at ttbook.org/death. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Our series on death is supported by the Neuer Foundation, dedicated to exploring meaning and commonality in human experience. More at neuerfoundation.com.
We've been talking about what it's like, or might be like, to die, which is not exactly a fun thing to think about, and it can be terrifying. Sometimes, when people get a terminal diagnosis, the fear and anxiety is so overwhelming, it can ruin the time they have left. Dr. Charles Grobe, a psychiatrist and researcher at Harbor UCLA Medical Center, believes he may have an answer: hallucinogens. He's been studying how psilocybin, the psychoactive component of magic mushrooms, can reduce death anxiety for end-stage cancer patients. He told Charles Monroe Kane how his experiments work.
We start with your typical drab hospital room, and we fixed it up very nicely. My two associates that I work with were very inventive in coming up with ways to really make the room more attractive, more appealing. We had lots of fabrics hanging from the ceiling, kind of cocooning them in. We brought in flowers for the day of the session. And we encourage subjects to bring in important mementos, particularly photographs from their past, including early past, and photographs of important relatives. Yeah. It was quite a moving experience to sit with them for those many hours while they went deep into the experience, for the most part just lying quietly in bed, eyes closed, eye shades on, headphones on, listening to music. Every hour we checked in with them, checked the blood pressure, I checked in, made sure they were okay. But I didn't want to engage in too much conversation during the acute effect stage. So again, I would encourage them after a while to just go deeply, and we would have lots of time later on to talk about what they were experiencing.
You know, I can't, I mean, we're talking about going deeply into their experience. These are people who are about to die. So right. The experience they're going deeply into is their own death. Why do you think they want to do this?
Well, I think many of our subjects were experiencing profound existential issues. They had lost their sense of meaning and purpose. And I think there was a sense that not only might the experience help them to be less anxious and less depressed, it might also kind of reconnect them with their core identity, which the illness often kind of takes them away from.
Can you give me an example? Is there some particular person you can think of that you just was profoundly changed by this experience and you saw it happen?
Sure. There was one woman. This was her first experience ever with a hallucinogen. She was in her, she's around 50 years old. She had a great deal of anxiety, had been isolating herself from friends, had kind of retreated from the world, waiting to die, and was just in a psychologically very disturbed state. That was her self-report. At the one-hour point when initially people start to inform us that there's something going on internally, she told us there was she wasn't having any experience yet. At the second-hour point, the same. At the third-hour point, she still said she wasn't having any experience. But, you know, at the four-hour point, when she told us that nothing was going on, I had one of the psychiatry residents working with us at that time, and I put him in charge of music selection, and I told him that, you know, I think you're playing music that's too mellow. Do you have anything that's a little more dissonant, that has a little more oomph to it? I think we need to challenge her a little more. And he said, well, I have nothing up here, but down in my car, I have Dead Can Dance.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great choice.
Lisa Gerrard and Dead Can Dance. Yeah. That was perfect. So I said, okay, go get it. He races down to the parking lot, gets the CD, brings it up, pops it in, and within 10 minutes, the floodgates had opened, and tears are streaming down her face. And, you know, I just let her cry. And meanwhile, I'm assuming that why she's crying is because she's getting in touch with her shortened life expectancy. But when I checked in at the next hour point, I found out that that was nothing at all like what was really going on, that her subjective experience was essentially getting in touch with memories of her father, who had long since been deceased. And she said she cried for the lost opportunities she had had while he was still alive to tell him how much she loved him. And they were not an expressive family. And she cried because while she knew that he loved her, he had never expressed that to her. And for her, it was a very, very healing experience. And afterwards, her anxiety appeared much less. She had previously, before the study, been on an antidepressant, but afterwards she found no need to go back on the antidepressant.
Incredible.
That it really seemed to re-equilibrate her mood.
You know, I would assume at least a number of our listeners have taken hallucinogens before. Mushrooms with friends in the woods, mescaline at a rave, LSD at a Grateful Dead concert, or I bet if I asked them all in a survey, if they wanted to take a bunch of hallucinogens in a hospital and contemplate their own death, they would say, man, that sounds like a terrible trip. Obviously, for patients, it was not a bad trip. What's the difference?
Well, you know, I think when individuals are really confronting such a challenging predicament as the approaching end of life, you know, they are willing to undertake such an experience as we offered. All of our subjects expressed a lot of gratitude that this opportunity was open to them. And of course, I think if we had asked them years earlier when they were in their prime of health, most of them would not likely have accepted such an invitation. I think it really takes extreme circumstance for people to step up and say, I'm willing to try that.
You know, if you were diagnosed with terminal cancer and had only a few months to live, would you want to take psilocybin in your final days?
Well, I think that would be an option well worth considering, as long as it was feasible to do it in an approved, sanctioned manner with facilitators who knew what they were doing and could help to create optimal conditions. Observing what I observed in my patients, absolutely.
Do you think that psilocybin would help for people who aren't terminal but still want to come to grips in a proper environment with the idea of death or even the idea of an existential crisis? Would you suggest that?
One approach we've considered, you know, the possibility of facilitating a treatment for the partner of the individual who is dying, because that person is also quite often in crisis. For them, denial has been stripped away, you know, and also to really help them prepare for the grieving process. I think that might be an interesting model to work with next.
Yeah, especially if they did it together, it seems like that could be a very, very, very powerful experience for a couple.
Well, you know, together would have some logistical issues, but I would also say that with some of our subjects, what was also quite notable was the very, very significant improvement in the quality of their relationships with significant others. I've had some subjects whose important relationships seem to be on the rocks with the stress of what was going on. And after their treatment, at least with some of our subjects, it was quite moving to see the manner in which they were able to connect and bond with their significant other and other family members.
Charles Grobe is a psychiatrist and researcher at Harbor UCLA Medical Center. If you want to know more about his research on psilocybin and the end of life, visit our website. That's at ttbook.org/death. You know, one undeniable fact is that we will all have our own moment of death. And Buddhist chaplain Stephen Spiro says we can choose to be more or less conscious in that moment. Spiro leads workshops on death, dying, and letting go, and he works as a counselor to the dying. Sarah Nix wanted to know more about this thing called conscious dying.
My understanding is that sometimes when you're working with people, you encourage them or walk them through a kind of meditation on their own death. Mm-hmm. Could you explain how that works?
Well, first, let me say that there are really stages of preparing for death, whether we have a terminal diagnosis or whether we're 21 years old. In my opinion, a lot of what the wisdom traditions have been teaching over the millennia are spiritual practices that allow us to let go. And so, in a way, spiritual practice is walking the path of dying.
I once had a yoga teacher who, in Shavasana, in the resting period at the end of the yoga class, offered a visualization to us that is pretty untraditional in the westernized yoga tradition, which is that after all the kind of relaxing the face, relaxing the feet, relaxing the hands, so on and so forth, he said, now imagine that you are 6 feet underground and the soil is pressing you into the soil underneath you, and there is nothing to do. There is no action necessary. And for me, it was a beautiful moment of release of any intention or agency. And every so often, very rarely, I suffer from insomnia, and I remember that again. I do that again. I imagine being 6 feet under, being buried underground, and just being kind of contained. And it's fascinating to me because when I mention it to other people, generally, they find the notion appalling. I wonder what kind of responses you get when you ask people to confront the true notion of mortality, their mortality.
Let me tell you a story about this. So when I lived out in the country, I was a volunteer EMT. And one call we went to was for a gentleman in his late 80s. Who had suffered a heart attack. And by the time we got to the scene, it was in a house, he was lying on the floor and he was dead. There was just no question about it. There was no treatment, nothing we could do. So we called the coroner and we waited. And this is in a very rural area and it took a long time. And it was a sad scene. You know, a lot of the family was there. It was very sad. And so eventually, they took the body away, and we dispersed, and I went home. And I always do a meditation after any kind of a call just to sort of release it. And I did that, and suddenly I had this unbelievable experience of incredible joy. And everything was luminous. You know, the chair, the light, you know, the dog, you know, my wife. Everything was just luminous, and I said, what is going on here? And the answer came to me right away. I'm not dead. That man was dead. And I'm alive. And it brought this amazing immediacy and intensity to my experience, which is possible, you know, to bring in more and more and more and to really enliven, you know, our life. So that's a reason for these kind of practices. Life becomes sweeter.
It sounds like what you're saying is that being mindful of our mortality, essentially, creates the possibility for us to be more conscious in our living. And you're also a proponent of conscious dying. I wonder if you could explain just a bit what that is.
Well, you know there's the Woody Allen quote.
I don't know it.
I don't mind dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens. You know, I think that's a lot of people agree with that. I think the conscious aspect can come in terms of planning. So we can plan at many different levels. You know, we can plan at practical levels. You know, writing wills and getting our affairs in order.
Advanced medical directives.
All of those things, mm-hmm. Very important. We can take a little step deeper and we can plan at a relational level. Who am I at odds with in my life? Who do I need to forgive? Who needs to forgive me? There's a lot of suffering when people don't do these things. So that's part of conscious dying.
You have this, you shared with me an advanced directive for conscious dying, mm-hmm. which I filled out.
Uh-huh. Good for you.
It was really interesting to do it. You know, you have questions here about who do you want to be with you most and who do you not want there? Mm-hmm. Some of those answers for me were really surprising. Mm-hmm. What are some of the responses that you get to this process of figuring out, if we are given the luxury of time, how we would like to use those final weeks?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just the exercise of imagining a scenario where we are dying sets things up in stark contrast. So I really don't want that person there. I really want to see these people. I really want these, all of these kinds of issues that are brought up in the Advanced Directive for Conscious Dying suddenly become real. And so the exercise of filling these out and thinking about these things may be extremely useful for how you're going to live 5 minutes from now. Well, now, maybe I will give that person a call. Or what about...
Maybe I will issue that apology. Maybe I will make sure they know I love them now.
Yeah, exactly.
Filling this out was really interesting for me, and thank you for sharing it. And one of the things that was most surprising to me and really made me pause is one question that you have, and you ask, how strictly do you want your wishes to be adhered to? By your loved ones? Do you want them to do exactly as you say, even if they may be uncomfortable? Do you want your loved ones to do what brings them the most peace? And I wondered how much about this conscious dying movement is about claiming ownership of our deaths in a way and or sharing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we don't want to encourage clinging to a certain scenario either. And that's why that question is in there. You know, here's how I see it all unfolding, and I'm ready to let go of it. There was a woman who declared that she's a deep Buddhist practitioner and just made it very clear to everyone that she did not want any kind of drug. She didn't want morphine or anything like that. And it puts those around her into an ethical dilemma at a certain point.
Because she's visibly suffering.
Visibly suffering. And it reaches a point where someone has to say, we need to override this. And so giving permission for that as an example, I think is very important.
What have you seen in terms of the most common challenges that come up for people to die as peacefully as possible?
A lot of times we're afraid of leaving people who we don't know if they're going to be okay without us, you know. And so we talk about the five things that we want said at the end of life. First one's I love you. Second one is I forgive you. Third one is please forgive me. Fourth one is thank you. Thank you for your life. And the fifth one is, it's okay. It's okay to die. I'll be okay if you die. They'll be okay if you die. You'll be okay if you die. All of those things. So the impediments can arise at any one of those levels.
So in this directive for conscious dying, one of the things that I kept wondering was, well, I felt a sense of ownership over my death that I had never felt before, my theoretical death. Mm-hmm. But then I started to wonder how much it is actually for other people, making space for other people to have their experience of my death as well.
It's so true. Humans have tried not to die alone, I think, for as long as we've been around. We've wanted this to be an event that's shared. And we can think about other people in our lives who've died. My grandmother or my father or whoever it was, what impact that had on my life. And then turn it around and say, what impact will my death and how I die, what impact will that have on other people?
It's our final act in a way.
Indeed. And can be our final gift.
Sarah Nix talking with Stephen Spiro. He's a Buddhist chaplain from Madison, Wisconsin. And you can find a link on our website to some resources he's put together on preparing for the end of life, including that advanced directive on conscious dying. Click on resources at ttbook.org/death. And remember how a few weeks ago we asked you to weigh in on our question about how you would choose to die? Well, you weighed in, all right. Thanks for some really thoughtful and occasionally funny answers. You can read them and add your own on our homepage, ttbook.org. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today's show was produced by Sarah Nix, Doug Gordon, Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and Charles Monroe Kane. Theme music by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. I'm Ann Strainchamps. And the last word in this hour goes to the poet, Christian Wyman.
Here's a little poem called For D, and D is my wife. Groans going all the way up a young tree, half cracked and caught in the crook of another. Pause. All around the hill-ringed, heavened pond, leaves shush themselves like an audience. A cellular stillness, as of some huge attention bearing down. May I hold your hand? A clutch of mayflies, banqueting on oblivion, writhes above the water like visible light.
PRI, Public Radio International.